Recordings have started.
Great. Thanks so much, Hannah. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms Subteam for Data meeting on the 15th of June, 2018. On the call today, we do have Christine Durain, Susan Payne, and Rebecca Tushnet. We do have guest speakers Greg Rafert and Stacey Chan, both from the analysis group. We have apologies from Michael Graham. From ICANN staff, we have Julie Headland, Barry Cobb, Ariel Liang, Antonietta Mangiacati, and myself, Michelle DeSmider. As a reminder, if you would please state your name before speaking for recording purposes, and I'll turn the meeting back over to Julie Headland. Please begin.
Oh, thank you very much, Michelle. I appreciate it. And thank you all for joining for another one of these calls. We do really very much appreciate it. And as we've been doing previously, we'll go ahead and use the link to the Google Doc as the way to walk through the document. The link is actually up in the agenda meeting in details, but here, let's go, and Ariel's faster than I am, and thank you, Ariel, for putting it into the chat. So our call today, we're probably not going to make it past the registrant survey, but we've got the link to the potential registrant survey there just in case we do. And thanks, Stacey. I do note the apologies from Greg that he can't join, but thank you so much for joining us. So I'm going to move to the Google Doc, and I'm going to suggest that we could go ahead and go ahead and walk through the questions and calling out where we have comments. And I see that there are comments from Rebecca, so I think I'll probably go to those and read those out and see if Rebecca has anything she'd like to add, and we can just go into a discussion that way. So unless I see any objections from anybody, then why don't we go ahead and dive right in. So I'm not seeing any comments on question one. Question two, however, we've got some comments. If we go ahead and look at a couple of the bullet points here, under question two, the second bullet point, the selection is no, I registered a domain name and a new GTLD more than 3 years ago, but would consider doing it again in the future. Rebecca is noting, I don't understand this one. I think the issue may be this. If they registered before 2014, someone here must know the exact date, but I don't maybe need to update the date given when the survey is going out. We know that they can't have registered a new GTLD because those weren't available at the time. I would delete this question, hoping the reason for the date is now clearer. And there's then a comment on the next two bullets as well, where no, I attempted to register a domain name and a new GTLD but did not complete the registration, and no, I've never attempted to register a domain name and a new GTLD but considered doing so in the future. And here Rebecca says, important, move these two categories of no's to the potential registrants if they selected no. I attempted or no, but I would consider doing so. These are precisely the people we want for potential registrants, and we should be happy to find them in this group. I want to make sure we get cross-reference going. And then there's another comment. It says, terminate if respondent does not select yes, I have registered. And noting from Rebecca, move to potential registrants, terminate if no and not interested or don't know, not sure. Okay, so with those comments, let me see if anybody has a hand raised and wants to disagree with those suggestions or has any questions. And welcome to Phil and to Lori for joining us. And Christine, please go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine. I just wanted to give Rebecca a chance to chime in first, so I wasn't trying to delay. I agree with everything Rebecca wrote. The one thing I wanted to add, I know it comes up later when we say the words 3 years. Actually, the very first new GTLD launched in July 2013. It was .shabaka. So we're probably going to want to go back to 5 years, just, you know, because that's the math. This is not really going to go out before July of 2018. So we may want to just change that to 5 years. Secondly, I agree that if we've got somebody already on the survey and they say, no, but I've attempted, but I didn't complete it, or I would consider doing so, I think the intent all along was to take those and shove those into the potential registrants camp. I didn't think we were, well, thanks for participating, and then, you know, find a whole new list of people. So I don't know how it's like planning to work on the back end, but that it was definitely our intention all along, as I recall. So I support everything Rebecca said there, and wanted to make a comment about the 3 years. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Christine. And I see Susan Payne in the chat. It says, greed, read potentials. Let me just ask Stacy, so how will this work then if we want to have these folks funneled into the potential registrants? Can that work on the back end? I don't mean that you have to get into a lot of technical details, but what they're suggesting here, is that clear, and is that something that you'd be able to do?
Hi, thanks. This is Stacy. Yes, that is something that we were hoping to incorporate, just so that we can maximize the number of responses that we're getting to each survey. So that is something that we can do.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Then moving along, question two does not have any okay, question two is 2A is really a repeat of one, and I guess that's just because if it terminates, then you're sort of starting again. And I hear somebody's mic is open. I think I'm hearing some typing.
Oh, my apologies.
That's okay. I didn't mean to suggest it was you, Lori. Just heard some typing. Very fast typing. Thanks. Question QB, there is a comment here. It says, how many domain names have you attempted to register within the past 3 years? I think it's, with 3 years selected, I think we've seen in the chat here and echoing what Christine said, that should probably be changed to 5 years. And moving down, question 2C has no comments associated with it. That's how many domain names have you registered new GTLDs past 3 years, but then that, I imagine, also has to change to 5 years. Would that be correct? And question 2D, if you recall, which which GTLD or GTLDs did you register your domain name open field? 2E, when you attempted to register your domain names, did you ever receive a claims notice of possible trademark conflict? And here we have multiple comments. So under the don't know, not sure, Rebecca says, for this one, if they're not sure, I would ask a follow-up. Why are you not sure? And on the bullet, if yes, did you register the domain name for which you received a claims notice? Yes, no, don't know, not sure. Rebecca says, since this is the core question we have for registrants, this one deserves a please explain why you did this, whether the answer is yes or no. Thank you. And then on if yes, have you received such a claims notice in more than one occasion? Rebecca says, if we're going to ask this, we should ask what they did for the additional notices they received as well. Okay, anyone disagree with those suggestions? Susan Payne is saying, yep. Susan, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, it's Susan. I'm not sure I quite follow what Rebecca's suggesting. So hopefully maybe she can clarify. I'm thinking in particular of this comment that says this is the core question we have for registrants. Dissolves, please explain why you did this. I mean, they haven't done anything. They've only tried to register a domain name and got a claims notice. So I'm not sure what we're asking them. I wonder, Rebecca, can you Can you, I think I'm being a bit dim, but can you explain?
Rebecca Tushnet, yes. So so the question is, you know, when you attempted to register, did you receive a claims notice? If the answer is yes, we ask, did you register? Did you complete it? Right? Well, we want to know why, right? So why did you, we want to hear them talk about why they went ahead despite receiving a claims notice. That's actually really important to see, you know, what are the set of people who receive these and still go forward. We have reason to think it's small, but we don't know what's going on with them. So, you know, qualitatively, what are they like? So maybe the answer is, you know, I consulted with counsel and they said, you have every right to go to do this, and they did it. If the answer is they didn't register the domain name for which they received a claims notice, then that's something we want to know, you know, why not? You know, and this goes into the same set of questions that we deal with below, right? Too much trouble, whatever, but we don't know. And then I assume that the same rationale applies the second time they received it, or third, you know, if there are more. I hope that helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Susan, please. And then Christine.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, thank you. That helps a lot. Sorry, I knew I was being dim. Thanks.
Thanks, Susan. Christine, please.
Yeah, this is Christine. Thanks. I just want to tag on to that because, you know, to Rebecca's point, and I agree with what she said, you know, we spend a whole lot of time asking why people did not proceed, which is good because we wanted to do that. And I think that Nelson's group did a really good job here. And maybe this is all kudos to Rebecca for her detail in actually putting the survey draft together here. But I mean, we have a lot of reasons, you know, why didn't you proceed? It was too expensive. It would, you know, it was too much time. You know, why, you know, lots of reasons. Do you understand the claims notice? That sort of thing. But they all go to attempted but not completed. We do actually have some of those same questions for those who received the notice and clicked, yes, I'm going to keep going anyway, such as, excuse me, skipping down ahead, like I felt like I had a superior legal claim, or I didn't think that the person who was claiming a, you know, I thought it was illegitimate. I didn't understand it. I just clicked through. You know, and then, of course, leaving that open-ended option. But I feel like we're giving the people that proceeded through the actual registration short shrift here because they made some very serious decisions at that point that we need to know more about. So I like the way we dove in to why they didn't proceed. But I think we also need to dive in a little bit more into why they did proceed. And I actually think that a please explain why, while I think that's one of the questions, I like the idea of providing some more multiple choice options again for people because I think we do want to dig into, you know, why they proceeded and dig into a little bit more understanding. I mean, we're going to get into later, is the wording right or wrong? And you might have someone who proceeded anyway, but we have no concept at this point of whether they should have proceeded or not. If they just said, because I click everything, well, that doesn't help us, right? So I think we need to dive deeper.
Thank you, Christine. May I ask Stacy, is it clear then what we're asking as far as some changes here?
Yes, I think so. We can certainly dig deeper on this question. If the team would like to have that follow-up question as a multiple choice, it would be helpful to if you could share those multiple choice options with us. We could also do this as an open text field. But multiple choice is easier for respondents.
All right. Thank you. So I'm wondering if we could just think a little bit about what the multiple choice options might be here while we have everybody here. Rebecca, Christine, Susan, do you have any thoughts on what might work for the multiple choice options? And just, yeah, Christine, please go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine. I'm just going to launch this out because we have to have a pinata that we can all hit. I'm not necessarily committed to this idea, full disclosure. But I'm looking at the doc where on page 23, not the Google Doc, but the one in the Adobe where Rebecca had heard comments. And it says, if when registering you decided to abandon the registration, why? You thought you'd be sued, you'd be subject to an action to take, yet someone else had a legal right. What if we start with the idea, and the wording's not going to be right, but what if we start with the idea if we flip it? So I wasn't worried about being sued because I have a superior right. I'm not subject to, didn't believe I was subject to any actions. I wasn't worried about losing the domain. I didn't believe that the right was legitimate. I believed that it was, it was no trouble, cost benefit. I mean, I wonder if we want to start there and revise, just to throw it out as an option. Rebecca, go ahead.
Yeah, so Rebecca Tashnet, thank you. So those all sound good. The only thing I would say, and subject to, our survey experts, is I just wouldn't put a reason, I think the first one you gave did suggest a reason, and I'm sorry, I've lost the words already. It's always risky to give somebody one answer that has a reason because they may glom onto it. The other thing, which I'm not sure you listed, is, I consulted an attorney who said it was fine. The other possibilities are, I was committed to the domain name, for personal reasons. I was committed to the domain name for business reasons, something like that.
Oh, thank you, Rebecca. And, and I'll note that then, as you're pointing to, as Christine pointed to, page 23 in the RFP appendix table, kind of going, sort of taking the opposite of those options is helpful as well. And Susan's noting in the chat also, I didn't understand the notice, and Christine saying it matched investments names I already own in a portfolio going with the theme registrants. Christine, please go ahead.
Thanks, this is Christine. Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to go there, maybe Rebecca mentioned it, but it's part of a bigger business strategy, I guess. I don't want to, I'm really hesitant, and I'm saying this mostly for Stacy's benefit, is we have to be careful that we don't inadvertently ascribe bad intentions to people. So we don't want to make it seem like having an investment portfolio of names is somehow a bad thing. So to Stacy's, for Stacy, we just want to make sure that when we word this question, it provides these as legitimate, reasonable options of, I collect domain names that are of such and such type, and it matched my type or my business strategy. So that's what I'm getting at when I say it matched investment names I already own. My wording was bad, but I'm hoping you get the drift there. Thanks.
Thanks, Christine. And I see in the chat, Rebecca says, plus one for I didn't understand the notice. So, Stacy, does that give you enough to work with to come up with some multiple choice questions?
Yes, thank you. This was very helpful.
Great. Thanks so much. Okay. Then moving along, and actually let me see. So moving along to question 2F. I'm not seeing any comments on that one. I'm missing a comment here. And I can't tell what it's attributed to. Okay. And I think Rebecca already mentioned this, but again, with 2E and receiving claims notices, Rebecca noted, if we're going to ask this, we should ask what they did for the additional notices they received as well. And then there's other comments. I see your hand, Christine. I just want to make sure we cover these other comments. Because I think they all relate. So possible rephrase, have you received such a claims notice when attempting to register any other domain names? Could also do yes more than once, yes once, no, and don't know, not sure in the initial funnel, and use that to ask the more than once folks to answer until they're done. And then Rebecca says, Stacey Chan notes below that recall may be difficult, which is true, but we have to give them the opportunity to explain. This is the thing we most need to know. How does the notice affect the thinking of would-be registrants? So I think I've covered all of the comments relating to question 2E. And please go ahead, Christine.
Thank you. My comment further relates to question 2E, so this is fine. So question 2E, I'm looking at Rebecca's comment about asking it again for multiple notices. I'm thinking about a way that might streamline it and be interested in some feedback. So obviously, we're not going to be able to get this for every domain name, especially if someone had more than one. I mean, there's going to be portfolio registrants, those, like, you know, partially are some of the people we want to hit, and they might have registered thousands, right? So they might have received hundreds of claims notices. I don't know. So I think what you might want to ask is, if you attempted to register domain names, did you ever receive a claims notice of possible trademark conflict? We might ask sort of a more of a quantitative question. You know, how many times did this happen for you? 1, 10, 15, 100, you know, whatever we decide the spacing to be. And then if you proceeded to register the domain name for any of those for which you received a claims notice, you know, then, you know, what tick all that apply? And that goes to Rebecca's point of we hate to give them a reason, right? So give them a smorgasbord of reasons and then tick all that apply. You know, were there five different reasons for this, you know, 20 domain names that you received claims notices for? Or if you only had one, what was, you know, did you have two reasons? So it kind of allows us to gather more information about the things that people considered. Just a possible way to reorganize it. I'd be really interested to hear what other people thought of that. But I think that might get to this sort of one claims notice versus multiple versus one reason versus multiple reasons. And it would be a little bit more streamlined.
Oh, thank you so much, Christine. Any comments to Christine's suggestion? In particular, I guess I'm wondering, Rebecca, if you think that that might be a helpful approach.
So I'm basically okay with that. Sorry, Rebecca Teschnet, for the record. What I'm a little concerned about is, you know, if God is kind, we might actually get someone who'd gotten a bunch of these and, you know, maybe ticks five boxes. It would be really, really helpful to know, though, if those were, you know, the reasons that they always continued. Or say, for some set they had reason one, for some set they had reason two and three, right? So if there's any way to, especially if they answer in the larger numbers, encourage them to write a narrative, sort of explaining themselves, I think that would be really important. Now, you know, we may not get any of those people, but if we did, we should squeeze them for all their worth. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I see that Susan has a note in the chat. I think that would work, bearing in mind that some people could have big portfolios, and I see others are typing. And by the way, welcome to Michael. Michael, I think we have you in the room twice, so that is good as well. And Michael, we're just on question 2E so far. So let me ask, while I see others are typing, Stacey, if what is being suggested here makes sense to you, if you need more explanation. And Susan says, my comment was relating to Christine's suggestion. Right.
Great. Thanks. This is Stacey. Yes, I think this conversation is clear, so we can take these comments into consideration. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much. And I see Christine is typing, but let me ask, are there any other comments on 2E? Otherwise, I'm seeing that there are no comments in the Google Doc on 2F. The next comment is on question 2G, and here we have a comment from Stacey and then from Rebecca. Registrants may have abandoned registrations in the past. This could represent an opportunity to ask questions regarding abandonment, i.e. follow the potential registrant survey. Excuse me, questions from the potential registrant survey are included here. And Rebecca says, great idea. I just want to make sure we also funnel in the, and here I'm just, Kathy's entering the room. I just want to, that we funnel in the no slash would consider types into the potential registrant survey as well. And looking at Christine's comment, and to be clear, I was not advocating for completely removing the narrative option either. And Lori, please go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about narrative options generally, because it seems to me every time we go through a different version of the survey for different recipients, we seem to always want to have that net, so to speak, to catch comments here and there. So just from a usability perspective, is it wise to, and I'm asking Stacey, and I think is Greg on the call or Stacey, is it wise to do that, to leave as much narrative open as possible in terms of feedback we may be getting? I mean, intuitively, I would say yes, because this gives people the opportunity to get whatever's on their mind onto the paper so we could evaluate whatever comments come in. On the other hand, I'm wondering if it makes the survey look too cumbersome. And I just want to understand if you know, continually having open-ended narrative boxes could be helpful or hurtful to the overall result and completion rate.
Thanks, Lori. And I guess that's a question for Stacey. Do you have some thoughts there that you'd like to provide?
Sure, thanks. This is Stacey. That is a great question. So narrative responses can cut both ways. So I do understand the sub-team's interest in receiving as much information as possible regarding the questions that you have for respondents. They can become cumbersome. It's fine to have a few in a survey, but the more complicated the question is, or the more loaded the answer would be, then the more time and the more thought needs to go into the response on the respondent side. And so having numerous of those can cause the amount of time that the survey takes to add up, and it can also feel to the respondent that they're putting a lot of energy into the survey when or more energy than they initially thought they would need to. So too many of those questions can cause problems for response rates and also for dropout rates. Another thing about open text responses is the question needs to be worded very clearly, because depending how the question is worded, you could get a very wide variety of responses that may or may not be on track with the response that you are going for. Sometimes open text questions are better in, say, an interview setting, where you can kind of respond to the survey respondent as they're giving an answer so you can redirect them. But when it's a form survey, like these surveys will be, you don't have an opportunity to redirect the answer. You just kind of get whatever the survey respondent thought you were asking about or whatever they felt like talking about, which can or cannot be helpful. And then another thing to consider with open text fields is with the responses, again, this kind of ties back to the wide range of types of responses or topics that may be covered by the responses. It can make analysis of the responses a bit difficult to summarize in a simple way. For example, with this kind of subject material, where we've been trying to figure out ways to convert a lot of the open text responses to multiple choice, because multiple choice answers are very easy to quantify and represent in a summarization of results, whereas with open text fields, if you want to have a nice summary, one way to approach it is to try and categorize the responses at the back end, and so it's kind of shifting work from the front to the back, and that can be time-consuming.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And Lori, I see your hand is still up, and then I see Christine.
Sorry, I put myself back on mute. So I see where Stacey's coming from, and I just wanted to make sure, I guess when we look at this overall finally, that we have the right balance. That's just my concern in a nutshell, that we don't go overboard by having too many of these narrative questions.
Thanks, Lori. And Christine?
I think. Yeah, this is Christine. I support that, what Lori said. I also want us to think a little bit as when we look through the final version, I'm wondering if we need to also differentiate between where we say other, you know, fill in the blank, you know, like, you know, we give them five choices and somebody wants to click other. Does that, like, what count that as a narrative? That's just like, you know, filling in a different answer. And then if you say yes or no and then why, you know, and then you sort of give like, you know, a 10-word or 20-word answer. I approach that in my mind differently, like an explanation as a different type of narrative than just sort of tell me what you thought about, or did you tell me about all your war stories about this or that or the other thing, because I know we were definitely trying to limit the war story blocks. So maybe we can just keep that in mind, and maybe I feel like that's where we're headed, and I hope that we all have that in mind. But maybe analysis group can tell us, maybe I'm misunderstanding. Maybe a box is a box is a box. But in my mind, you know, there's sort of the focus, you know, fill in some different answer or tell us why versus just open-ended, tell us everything you want to tell us. Is there a difference?
Stacey, do you have some comments with respect to Christine's question?
Sure, this is Stacey. Yes, I would say there is a difference between fill in and other option in a multiple choice where other is an option versus a large open text field where you're asking a very open-ended question.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And we had just read out the comment on question 2G talking about that this is an opportunity to ask questions regarding abandonment from Stacey, and Rebecca's comment, great idea. And funneling into the potential registrant survey. So I think I think there's agreement that we should take that opportunity, as Stacey has suggested, unless anybody has any objections to that on 2G. Not seeing any hands up. Moving on to 2H, I'm not seeing any comments on 2H. Unless anybody has one now, any now. There's a comment on, I think should be, okay, I have it, it's down as 2GI. And this one is, if respondent had zero domain names attempted but not completed, and the question is, do you recall receiving a claims notice during any of your registration attempts? And Rebecca said, I may misunderstood how this is structured in relation to the questions above. Suppose someone has registered some domain names and also not registered one due to a claims notice. Which of these questions will they see? Suppose they have answers that they have received a claims notice above and that they proceeded to register the domain name. Shouldn't in that case they see something like, we'd like to direct your attention to the situation or situations in which you received a claims notice, and then go on? And that, I think, pertains to the bullets below as well. Any comments on this? Does anybody have any thoughts on what Rebecca suggested? And I guess in particular I would ask Stacey if what Rebecca is pointing out makes sense as far as how the questions are structured. But first, let me go to Christine.
Thanks. This is Christine. Okay, so clearly I had not jumped ahead to question 2G1 before. I may be as confused as Rebecca here. So at the very top, so this is registered attempts that you did not complete. I'm going back to this idea of why attempted but not completed. Any time you receive a claims notice, we want to know how much time you spent reading it, what you thought about it, how you understood it. And then I think at that point is when you want to ask why you proceeded and the new questions that we're coming up with there. And then we can get into the sort of the why you didn't proceed and all the questions we just reviewed. And then I guess the following questions, 2G and below, go into that as well. But maybe I have the same question as Rebecca. I'm a little bit confused about the order, and maybe it's just because it's linear, and if you see a yes or a no, we have to go back. But I think we do need to make it really clear that this section, Q2G1, should apply to anyone who was presented with a claims notice, regardless of whether they completed that registration or not. And then we will use that information. We can then ask them about completions and non-completions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christine. So, Stacy, does the comments here make sense to you, sort of the progression of the asking of the questions or structuring the questions?
Yes, this is Stacy. Yes, that's helpful, and that does make sense.
Okay, so you have enough direction to know how to reorganize, but I see Christine. Please.
Thanks. This is Christine. I just want to add to the list, when it says, same question, which of the following best describes your understanding of the purpose? I just want to make it really sure where it says don't know, not sure. I feel like we should probably be even more clear. Like, I didn't know what it, I didn't understand the purpose. I didn't know what it was trying to tell me. I mean, I think don't know, not sure is kind of a vague answer, but I think you might want, like, I tried to read it and I just was confused as hell. And that's what we need a what the heck option there, I think.
Thanks, Christine. And Stacy, does that make sense to you?
Yes, that does. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Then moving along to question 2H, not seeing any comments on that. We do have a comment in another two, wait a minute, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong place. Please ignore me. Okay, going on to the next page, I have a question. Assume you were attempting to register the domain name virtue.food and received the following claims notice, et cetera. And Rebecca says, we should specify that it's for a new business selling food, just for clarity. And Christine, please.
Thanks. This is Christine. I'm kind of historically opposed to specifying because I'd hate for people to be given a false hypothetical. But what if we said, assume you were attempting to register the domain name virtue.food and you received the notice. Question Q2G2, would you consult attorney about this claims notice before deciding to proceed? Yes, no, I don't know. And then at the end, would your decision change if you were using this domain name, registering this domain name because you liked it? Yes or no? Because it was for a business plan you had? Yes or no? I mean, we could provide a couple of different options that would allow to dive a little bit deeper about how people think about these things. Because if the answer is, yeah, I proceed, I would not consult an attorney, and I think I have a right to register whatever the heck I want for any reason I want, well, that's one viewpoint. But you might get a whole bunch of people that assume that they have to register, you know, they can only be a legitimate business. I mean, I just think that there's an existing business. I don't want to say legitimate, an existing business or something, an existing business plan. I would hate to pigeonhole sort of like earlier. I think we want to give people the biggest benefit of the doubt and allow them to think of any potential use case for which they might be in this scenario. Thanks.
Thanks, Christine. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Tushnet. So that's fine with me. I would like to, get it out there, but certainly as multiple choice a bit later works for me as well. Right. So it might want to specify something like, only if I plan to start a business under that name or already had a business under that name or something like that. But doing it later is perfectly fine with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. And Susan, please. And Susan, if you're speaking.
Hi. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, that took it. Well, get off mute. I think I'm obviously not on all cylinders today because I'm just a bit confused about this one as well. Not so much the question, which makes sense, obviously, but I'm not sure I understand why we. If we specify something like it's for a new business selling food, and I think that has Christina was suggesting that we don't, but I mean if we were to do that, how does that help us any more than just having the name? I mean, I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm finding this one quite difficult to follow. I mean, what is it? Either way, when someone gets that claims notice, we don't know the background that they have in their head as to why they think they would proceed or not proceed. You know, we don't know if they think they've got their own trademark for the name or whether they're aware of another, you know, a brand that's called that's in the food industry. So I'm just not sure what we're going to get out of this.
Thank you, Susan. Rebecca, please. And then I have Kathy after Rebecca.
Rebecca Tushnet, thank you. So I think it's true that we don't know what they're thinking, which is why we got to ask them, right? And so if it turns out that the story they have in their head is, you know, I would continue if I had a business that I thought was legitimate, or I would continue if I thought I had something to say about virtue and, you know, virtuous eating. Then we'll at least have insight into the kinds of ways people think about domain names of this type, and it is, I think, much more likely to get useful answers if we give them an example to think with, and then they can tell us what it made them think about. If we just give them the notice, I think the reaction is going to be, well, how the hell should I know? Like, at least, you know, tell me what it's for, because frankly, you know, my answer would be completely different if it was virtue.food versus if it was Xerox.food. So I need to know something. And I also expect that there's probably consensus in the working group that we don't really think that it's a problem if someone's deterred from registering Xerox.food in most circumstances. So it's the virtue people or really the hotel people, right, the cloud people that we really want to know about, given what we know about claims notices. So I think an example is going to help us do that, even though, of course, it will not answer all our questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Kathy, please.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to Rebecca, and I also just want to note that we did give examples to, I think, registries, but it could have been registrars or both, when it came to things like window.construction and police.nyc. We did give some concrete examples, I think, on alternate or limited registration periods and things like that. So that example just helps, especially when we're dealing with non-experts. I think the example will help. And then to have a range of answers, I think the way Christine pointed out, makes sense to me as well. Thanks.
Kathy, I have Susan, and then Christine, please.
Yeah, sorry, I'm still a bit confused. I mean, so how do we know that there isn't a brand virtue for food? Or are you all aware of a brand virtue for food, and it's me who doesn't know anything about it? How do we, you know, no matter what we show the registrant or whatever they are, petitioner, whatever they are, how do we know what their level of knowledge is about whether that's an issue or not?
Thank you, Susan. Christine, and then Rebecca, please.
Thanks. This is Christine. Yeah, and I'm... That's sort of what I was getting at, and I know Rebecca thought we could ask sort of the clarifying questions at the end, but I almost feel like they have to be asked first to set context. To be clear, I am not arguing against virtue.food. I think if we want to have some sort of exam, that's fine. We could even put in parentheses hypothetical, you know, not no resemblance to anything else. What I don't care. But assume you were attempting to register the domain virtue.food and you receive the following claims notice. Take as much time as you want to read it. You're going to be asked a couple questions when you're ready. Then I think you almost need those demographic questions first. Like, you know, what is this, you know, would you be nervous registering this domain name if A, so yes or no, if A, you were, you know, thought this was a really cool domain name and you wanted to own it for, you know, personal use. If you wanted to buy this domain name as part of a portfolio for domain sales. If you were buying this on behalf of someone else. If you, you know, were thinking of starting a business. If you already had a business. Okay, some other, you know, other, or ubiquitous other, fill in the blank. You know, okay, given this, you know, information, you know, would you, for any case you answered yes, you would be nervous. What action would you take? You know, would you look at the price and keep going anyway because it's only 10 bucks, it doesn't matter? Would you consult with an attorney? Would you consider changing your use case? Would you abandon? If you said no, I wouldn't be nervous, you know, is it because, you know, I'm not worried about trademark law? Do I know about trademark law? So then you can get into some of these other questions, but I almost think you have to start with the demographic background questions to get into the mindset of our survey takers. And yes, we're not going to have, it's not going to be super consistent, but I think we're going to get some trends. Like either people generally get nervous, people are generally not nervous. People generally think it's okay for this, people generally think it's not okay for that. I think we could drill down a little bit better if we get them thinking about some sort of use cases for this hypothetical name, and then ask them questions on the, if for the ones you answered yes, where would you go from there? For the ones you answered no, and then you go on to how confident are you, and do you, you know, what, do you think trademarks matter? And again, we've got our four scenarios, at least four off the top of my head. You know, does trademark law matter when I'm just registering a domain name for myself? Does trademark law matter when I'm registering a domain name for an existing business? So I think that that's why I was suggesting collecting that at the front end, not waiting till the back end, because I think we can hone in a little bit better on our answer.
Thank you, Christine. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Tashnet. I'll defer to Stacey on this, but I'd be pretty worried about biasing responses if you start asking them about trademark law first. Like, how confident are you about how much you know about trademark law? I would worry that would have a pretty bad effect on the answers, and probably, and not necessarily one that any member of this working group would really want to see. So I don't know how feasible it is, given the size of the group, to, you know, divide this up. I also don't think, I think it's going to get super hard super fast if you ask each person to consider, you know, 10 different scenarios. If we were going to have 500 respondents, then I'd be super happy to, you know, test out, five different scenarios. And maybe that's feasible. Maybe Stacey could talk a little bit about that. But I don't think it's likely to get – I think you're likely to get people, just checking the box, I'm uncertain all the way, you know, now that you've raised this. Whereas there might be underlying differences in, you know, I wanted to write a food blog versus starting a business. I wanted to get back to the earlier concern. I don't know if there's – so, how, actually, that's not true. I am morally certain that there is some food company out there that has virtue in its name and is willing to claim trademark rights. I'm also morally certain that it is not Xerox and that it for that very reason, there are a range of potential – legitimate uses of virtue with respect to food. So no one should think that there's an absolute bar. But if you're really worried about some virtue business that respondents will know about and we don't, that's what the box is for, right? Like, I wouldn't want to compete with that other virtue. Or, you know, maybe they'll just answer, I think somebody else has trademark rights. That would be useful information. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. So where do we stand on rewording this? Back to Rebecca's initial comment, specify that it's a new business selling food, just for clarity. And if we look back at the questions, say on page 21, let me just say, I have to say I'm confused as to what the wording is that we want here and the order. And Rebecca says, I will withdraw that in favor of the alternative as giving it as an option later. Thank you, Rebecca. So giving it as an option later, then do we know where this will appear then in the series of questions? Again, I noted that there was concern about not leading off with a question about trademark law. And if we look at this question, then we look at question 2GII, we've got, zero domains attempted but not completed. Would you decide, consult with an attorney? Yes, no, don't know. We've got 2GIII, which talks about knowledge of trademark law. We've got G4 that talks about levels of confidence, and then H that talks about reasons for deciding to abandon. And thank you, Christine. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Christine. I agree. I think you're doing an admirable job, Julie, of trying to figure out what goes where. I'm really sitting with Rebecca's point, and I agree with it. Like, I don't. Something about me doesn't fit with asking the Q2G3, which is, describe your trademark law knowledge, and then I think, well, for sure that one, and then actually G4. How's your confidence in your ability to determine my legal liability for trademark infringement? I think we're making an assumption here that the user is going to assume that the claims notice has something to do with trademarks. And I feel like we are asked another question. So if you go up to the previous question, which is G1, one of our options is to inform me of ICANN's general policy on domain names or to inform me that someone else previously registered my domain name. So if assuming that we believe that those are possible legitimate answers here, and you dive right into three questions about attorneys and trademarks, I feel like it's a non sequitur. This whole section, I know what we're getting at. I think we're starting to hone in a little bit more on it. But I guess that's why I was going with the hypos. Like, if you were using it for this, what would you think? If you were using it for that, what do you think? Because I know we do at the end of the day want to know, like, what do you know about trademark law? Is it scary? But really, at the end of the day, we just want to know what people are thinking. And if we only ask trademark law-related questions and we lead with those, almost to Rebecca's point, we're planning it in their head. Oh, shit, I hadn't even thought about trademarks. I thought that claims notice meant, something else. So I'm a little bit worried about leading with trademarks, and I'm a little bit worried with assuming most people don't even know the difference between a trademark and a copyright. So they might just think, well, no, I'm not selling anything. Of course I'm not using a trademark. I just am a little bit worried that we're not getting at what we're trying to get at here, and I see a queue forming, so I'll shut up and hopefully I've sparked some discussion.
Thank you so much, Christine. And please, can I go to Susan?
Yeah, thanks. I think the only thing I'd say in response to that is that we are, at this point, we've shown them an actual claims notice, so we're not expecting them to remember what happened in the past and what they think they remember from when they saw one previously. We've just shown them one and said, take as long as you look at this. And all over it, it talks about trademarks, and I think it's called a trademark claim. Really, like, at that point, don't we need to get into the detail on the trademark part? That's surely why we're showing them the notice.
Thank you, Susan. Kathy, please.
Well, this is Rebecca. When
sorry, go ahead, Rebecca. Yes, and I see you've gotten off your computer. So just do chime in.
I think it's fair. We've shown them something called a trademark claims notice, but we don't know what that means to them. And the problem is not just that we are using the word trademark a bunch in these questions. It's that they have a very specific idea. Like, frankly, they're pretty suggestive. Trademark law is scary. And I think it's worth asking, but only after we've gotten some specifics out of them about a hypothetical and what they thought the notice was, because otherwise you really are going to trigger a very different set of reactions than if you ask those later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Kathy, please.
Thanks. I was just wondering how much we're redoing all this again. First, I had the same comment that Susan had, that it is the trademark claims notice, so it is in front of them. But also, it seems like we've done a lot of this before. Are we redoing this again? Is this new or old? I thought that the analysis group stayed fairly close to the original materials that they were given. So I just wonder, can we kind of go back to the original documents and just see and follow what Rebecca originally sent to them? Or is this very different? Thanks.
Well, thanks, Kathy. And I was attempting to do that as well, to look at, because I do think analysis group did try to follow what the original questions were, but I think maybe I have to say the order is unclear to me as well. And I think I'm perhaps hearing conflicting suggestions for how to order things, perhaps hearing that we should go for the hypothetical first and then go into, which is the order we have here, I think, the hypothetical, and then into the trademark law and attorney questions and so on. But, I'm happy to be corrected. Christine, please.
Thanks. This is Christine. So, first of all, I'm going to take a step back and say, here we have Q2G2 says, if the respondent has more than zero domain names attempted but not completed. So I don't know that we need to limit this question to only people who have not completed. I think anyone who's attempted and registered or not could talk about what they think about the claims notice, but we that's for one discussion point. Secondly, I'm going to attempt ordering here. So we show, okay, I'm taking Susan's point and I withdraw my objection to the trademark characterizations. So we've shown them something called trademark claims notice. The next question possibly then, for purposes of discussion, should be question 2G4. So how confident are you, given after they've seen sort of their, we've talked about sort of like what their use cases might be, how confident are you in your ability to determine if this claims notice affects your legal liability for trademark infringement? Yes or no? How confident are you? What are you good? From there, what would you do? Would you consult with an attorney if you're not confident? Or if you are, whatever, would you consult with an attorney? Why or why not? And then from there, you could maybe ask like a demographic question about the trademark law, but I don't know the value of asking that question, and I don't think that we asked that anywhere in our, I'm looking through, I don't think we asked about people's trademark law background. So I think if we reorder it to the how confident are you, then go to, and based on that, would you consult with an attorney? Then go to, if you abandoned a registration after noticing the claims notice, you know, why did you do that? But I think we've already sort of asked that question up above. So in this case, maybe it's if you would abandon, because here, I don't know, we're hypothetical again. So what do we think about that reordering? Starting with how confident are you in your ability to even make a legal determination for yourself? Then based on that, would you talk to an attorney? Get rid of the I know something about trademark law or I don't. And then from there, we've got to reword Q2H1 to be more in line with sort of after looking at the claims notice, if you are going to abandon your registration of virtue.food, for what reasons, select any, all, whatever, would you abandon that registration? Any thoughts there? I'm literally just throwing this up.
Thank you, Christine. That's really helpful. And I see Susan is saying in the chat, I like that reordering. And Michael is saying, if we ask, would you consult with an attorney, should we not also ask if they would talk with domain name registrar, et cetera? And I have Kathy and then Susan, please.
This is Kathy. I'm fine with the reordering, except that the deletion. I would keep that, even if we put it down at the end where it's unlikely to be answered because they'll have gotten lost in some of the other details perhaps. But that level of knowledge, that self-reporting level of knowledge, no way to verify, but I think will be very interesting in the end. And I think it's similar to some of the gateway threshold background type questions that the analysis group has added in other areas. I think we'll find that interesting in the end. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And just to clarify, you mean question 2G3, the one about knowledge of trademark law?
If that's the one Christine was proposing to delete, then yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And Susan, please.
Yes, thanks. Sorry, I'm trying to find the right. On 2H1, again, it might be because I've lost track of how this orders itself, but I don't, we've had this question about showing them the claims and would you consult, you know, the bit about how confident are you on trademark law and then the would you consult with an attorney? And then we don't have anything that says did you proceed or not, but we're suddenly asking people about why are they not proceeding with, and it doesn't seem to be with respect to Virtue.food. It seems to be with respect to some other names that they actually haven't applied for. So maybe I'm just, again, maybe it's just that I'm not understanding the order in this document because it's being displayed linearly. But where are we asking them what are they going to do about Virtue.food? Because it doesn't seem like we've asked them that. Or are we not, or do we not care? We just want to know if they'd go and speak to an attorney or not.
Thank you, Susan. And I have to say, I'm now really confused too. Christine.
Yes, thanks. This is Christine. So assuming we ask some sort of use case-y type questions earlier on and say, you know, for this use or that use, I agree completely, and I was trying to get to this at the end of my last sort of soliloquy, which is I think Q2H1 has to be supposed to the call of the question. If we're going the hypothetical route, if we're asking people, I'm going to use this for personal use / blog, I'm going to use this for a business, you know, if we're asking people to think about the claims notice in the context of Virtue.food and in the context of the reasons they might register Virtue.food, then we have to go on and say, you know, what would you, I mean, I shouldn't say we have to. The only way Q2H1 makes sense is if we then say, what would you do in your scenario? I agree, though, that I don't even know why we're asking it here, because we ask it above. When we say, did you actually get a claims notice? Did you actually abandon your registration then? Why did you abandon it? And we ask them at that time. So I'm not entirely sure that Q2H1 is adding anything either. But so, if anybody thinks it does, then we need to tie it back to Virtue.food, I think. Thanks.
So Rebecca is asking to get on the queue.
Go ahead, Rebecca, please.
Thank you. So I agree that I can't quite tell because it's linear. In a way, it won't be ultimately how this works. But my understanding was that the hypothetical is for everyone. So I agree that some of the respondents, ideally, will also have abandoned real registrations, and we'll ask them about that. But this is the question where we show people who haven't abandoned and who have a claims notice to refresh their recollection if necessary and to inform them if not, and then we ask them what it means to them. And so I absolutely agree we should be asking them, you know, what would you do? And, you know, and if we can, it'd be nice to give them scenarios, or we could ask them, to choose scenarios like, you know, I assume that I'd just be using it for a blog and so it wouldn't be worth it, or you know, I want to write a food blog, so it would be worth it, and so on. The hypothetical allows us to reach scenarios that they may not have encountered, they may not have thought about, but it allows them to process the meaning of the notice. But the real point is, I think everybody gets asked this, and that may require some care with the wording leading into it, but that's what it's useful for, because, frankly, I doubt we're going to get a whole lot of respondents who actually have received claim notices. I could be wrong, but my intuition is that this is where we're going to get most of our information about how potential and actual registrants understand the claims notice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. And just in the chat, Christine says, yes, Rebecca, that's a mistake in the premise of each question that the analysis group needs to resolve. And also, maybe this is the first question and there is a matrix. And Kathy says, so different paths of questioning need to be clarified. I'll go to Christine and then Susan, please.
Thanks. This is Christine just brainstorming again. So let's go back up to where we were thinking about our different use cases. You're attempting to register virtue.food. You received this claims notice. Please review it. We're going to ask you some questions. Question number one, it's a matrix. You're presented with different sort of business options. One is, I want it for personal use / will it, A, expose me to legal risk? Would the process of completion take too long and I would stop at this point for this use case? And we can come up with any of the other scenarios we already discussed. You know, it seemed confusing, it seemed too legal, it seemed too whatever it was, right? I already have a business. I'm thinking of starting a business. I just want to buy the domain name for my portfolio, other. And then you catch that information right up front. I looked at the claims notice. This is the decision I'm going to make for this particular path of virtue.food and what my use case for virtue.food. Then, now you haven't suggested anything to anybody yet. You've just said, give us your gut instinct. What are you going to do? Now you go into how confident are you in these decisions, which is Q2G4. Then you go into, and if you're not super confident, like, or even if you are, would you consult with an attorney? Why or why not? And then if we are going to ask the trademark question, we slap that in at the very, very end. Just, you know, for the purposes of demographics, how do you feel like you know about trademark law? How good are you at it? Maybe that's the way to get at it, because then you're not asking any of the leading questions first. What do you think?
This is Rebecca. I'd like to get on the queue.
Thanks, Rebecca. Let me go to you and then to Susan, please.
So I really like almost all of that, including the order in particular. The thing that makes me nervous is that if you, you know, start in with these multiple scenarios, you're immediately multiplying the scenarios in ways like maybe, you know, if it was a food blog, they'd go forward, and it was a business, they wouldn't, right? And so now we have zillions of possible answers, and I think that's going to get hard. So, you know, and I think it would be useful to hear from the experts on this point, one possibility would be to allow them to provide, well, what, you know, what do you imagine your use would be for, and then they could choose, and we'd send them down that path, and they'd answer based on that path. Or if we think we'll have enough respondents, we could subgroup, and then say, okay, you know, it was, you know, you're trying to develop a portfolio of valuable domain names, you're trying to start a business, you're trying to start a blog, right? If we could subgroup, then my worry would disappear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Susan, please.
Yeah, thanks. I've been feeling really uncomfortable about this conversation, and I realized as it was going on, it's because this is like deja vu. I mean, we had this, like a sort of endless discussion about hypotheticals when we were in the data subgroup ages ago, and I was just looking at our document that was provided to analysis group again, and if you go to page 28 and 29, we never within the subgroup reached an agreement on whether we used hypotheticals or not, and so there's this whole blurb where there's a rationale for supporting the use of hypotheticals and a rationale for opposing the use. Now, what happened with that? It seems like all of that went to analysis group. It doesn't seem like anyone has actually made a decision on whether we do hypotheticals or not. But this is making me really uncomfortable. We're just asking people to guess. You know, we're here with a bunch of people who've registered names and said they've had a claims notice and that they either proceeded or didn't proceed.
Rebecca, that's not true, though. That's not the entire group that we're reaching. We're also reaching a bunch of people who have never seen a claims notice.
But at the moment, we're doing the registrant survey. Anyway, let me continue. So we basically have a bunch of people who get a claims notice and haven't proceeded or have proceeded or whatever, and we can ask them a whole host of questions about what they did and whether they took advice and what their thinking was. But why are we then also asking them hypothetical questions, which as a group we didn't necessarily agree that we thought was the way forward? So I guess I'd like to understand how we've got back to hypotheticals when I thought we hadn't got agreement within the working group about this. But maybe staff can remind me that actually we had a working group discussion and the working group made a decision that hypotheticals were in. I think I'd like to know that.
Thank you, Susan. I've got Kathy and then Ariel, please.
Hi, this is Kathy. I thought we turned it over to the analysis group for their input and among other things. And we've got something back that at least as a registrant, I've been a registrant for many, many years now, makes sense to me. And hypotheticals, again, and this isn't a huge, you know, hypotheticals are a way that people get their head around things. And we did it very, very well for the limited registration periods, all these acronyms I don't remember, for different types of registration periods. Again, police.nyc, windows.construction. So here, this is a hypothetical that I think will help people who are coming to this anew. But I thought that what we did was we turned it over to the experts, and they came back to us with something. So maybe we should be asking Stacy. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And in the chat, I see Michael saying, we should not ask hypotheticals insofar as this would give us the same sort of opinions that we set out to get on real situations to circumvent. And there is an exclamation mark there. Lori Schulman says hypotheticals don't garner real-world data. And if new to server taker, then how helpful is that? Ariel, please.
Just as a staff clarification, so the information about hypotheticals, as Susan pointed out, is on page 28 and page 29, the statement supporting and opposing to hypotheticals. So this is all included in this appendix for analysis group to consider, and then staff don't really have any input or suggestion one way or another, but we just delivered this information for analysis groups to decide how they're going to draft their survey questions. So just a clarification here.
Thank you, Ariel. And Michael in the chat is saying, if we ask hypotheticals of registrants, I would like to return to TM brand owner survey to include some hypotheticals. What would be the difference? Lori is saying, I feel like there is a different kind of request for information that would be something to ask in the design phase of a project, not necessarily in an evaluation phase. And Kathy, I see your hand is still up.
It's an old hand, but an old question as well, whether Stacy can come on and talk with us about kind of reaching, you know, a broad group of individuals, which is the type of group we're talking about now, individuals, small businesses, entrepreneurs, and what helps them get their hands around, you know, complicated issues. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. I have Christine, and then we'll get some guidance perhaps from Stacy as well as their point of view. Christine, please.
Thanks. This is Christine. And thanks to Susan for reminding us about this whole, like, we didn't actually resolve the hypothetical question before. I note that I am the author of the opposing viewpoint that said we should not use hypotheticals. But I think, I don't know if we're mincing hairs here on what a hypothetical is. So my proposal, funnily enough, I hadn't even remembered this, but funnily enough, looking at page 29, what I'm proposing now is actually the same. But I think it could be truncated. Obviously, it was way wordier and longer in my original proposal. So I think getting to use cases is different than a hypothetical. So there's a relatively limited number of ways, categories in which domain names are used, right? I mean, you can have a kind of, like I've said it already, sort of personal/blog. You've got, you know, possible investment domain name. You know, you've got some potential plans for it. Maybe it's a business or something. Or you for sure have plans, like you actually know you're starting a business or you have a business. I mean, those are some general categories that people generally fall into. And that's sort of what I've outlined. Like, given those sort of general categories of why people register domain names, what would this claims notice, would it strike terror in your heart? Now, I have contended that we should not use an example domain name as a hypothetical. I am not currently dying on the virtue.food hill because I'm just not. But I'm wondering what the group thinks about this concept of use cases versus hypothetical. And because maybe it is just, 10 o'clock on a Friday and it's been a long week and I'm losing context here. But I'm not entirely sure what we're disagreeing on, actually, because I felt like we were kind of moving towards agreement. So what's the where are we disagreeing, and maybe how can we, resolve it? I'm not sure.
Thank you, Christine. And I see that Michael says mixing use and hypothetical questions would contaminate both types of answers. But I think, Christine, you're suggesting this is a use question, not a hypothetical. Kathy says, good question. And I see Susan is typing and Lori is typing. Maybe while that's going on, let me ask Stacy, now that you've heard all of this background, any thoughts that you might have on this, if this is a use case question, is it a hypothetical question, how useful is a question like that in this context? Thank you.
Thanks, and thanks everyone for this discussion. This is Stacy. I'm hearing multiple things related to this question and the hypothetical and how to phrase the hypothetical. First, to explain why this hypothetical ended up in the registrant survey, this is follow-up to earlier in the survey where there's a comment that we had gone through Q2G, which is at the bottom of page 2, where I had the comment registrants who are responding to the registrant survey may also have abandoned registrations in the past, so this could be an opportunity to ask some questions from the potential registrant survey. And so these Q2G, sub 1, 2, 3, et cetera, that we've been discussing, these hypothetical questions, are taken from the potential registrant survey. So it's possible that we may want to rethink whether or not it makes sense to present a hypothetical to respondents who have actually registered domain names. Maybe they would think about a hypothetical in a different way. We did end up including the hypothetical in the potential registrant survey, and I don't want to jump ahead because I know that we're not discussing the potential registrant survey right now, but that is where these questions are coming from. And I'm sorry, I think I'm going to need someone to redirect me at this point because I've started to lose the other points that were discussed in the rich conversation that was going on. But I'm happy to continue responding.
So this is Rebecca Teshnet, so whenever.
Yeah, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, so I think, Stacey, I think I myself have no desire to die on the hypothetical versus use case hill either. So the basic question it seems to me that we face is we want to know what some set of people who are the kind of people who register domain names. We want to know, when they see the trademark notice as it is currently worded, what is it doing to them, right? Because if we have good possibilities and bad possibilities, and right now we just don't know what it's doing to them. So this is an attempt to figure out what a person who sees this notice thinks, who is the kind of person who would see this notice. And the reason to provide use cases is that in the abstract, it's hard to understand what that kind of person, like me, right? I've registered domain names. In the abstract, I don't think anything about it because I assume I'd be doing something legitimate, but I'd need to know. So the reason for the use cases is to figure out what they think and what they think it means. And there's just no way to figure that out. And there's no way to ask them questions without them something to think about. Because you sort of hit, you know, you were trying to register a domain name and you got this. I think the first question they'd ask, or they would just assume an answer to it, and then we're in even more trouble because we have no idea what's going on in their head. The first thing they ask is, well, what the hell am I trying to register? Before they start answering the question of what it would mean to them. The use cases are the way of getting it out of the mysterious depths of their heads and at least giving us some purchase on what they might be thinking. So I guess I would like Stacey to speak to, you know, what is the way, what is the best way to figure out what this notice means to the kind of people who might register? Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Very helpful. And Stacey, then, does that provide a little bit more guidance of what the subteam is looking for here and the kind of responses they're hoping to elicit?
Thank you. Yes, this is Stacey. Yes, thanks, Rebecca. That is very helpful. And I do see that issue with asking the hypothetical without really understanding where the true background for whatever responses would come in response to the hypothetical. And so I guess I have two thoughts. One is perhaps it would make sense to keep this hypothetical situation for potential registrants and revisit it when we discuss the potential registrant survey, and then make sure that we have questions in this registrant survey when we're asking questions about whether or not the registrant received a claims notice, if they did, how they responded to it, having some question in this survey about what the purpose was behind their registrations, when they're giving reasons for continuing or not continuing with the registration. And I'm wondering if that would get at those issues.
Thank you, Stacey. And I'll just note a couple of comments in the chat as we've been talking here. So Lori says, I think that asking what you would do is fundamentally different than what you have done. Susan says, and I guess I'm okay with the page 29 scenario since we get an understanding of what the respondent is thinking when they answer. And Christine says, agree, Lori, the section above is for what you've already done. This section is just what do you think about the claims notice. Michael says, and he does say, yes, to leave the call, that questions about actual events and actions will provide metrics. Hypotheticals will...
This is Rebecca. I'd like to...
Yeah, please. And Michael says, we think about what should relate to what they actually thought, not what they might have thought. Please go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, this is Rebecca Tuss. So, consumer perception surveys are access. And, you know, in many...
I think you just dropped out for us, Rebecca.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So consumer perception surveys are actual data. They, so you are, or there are a number of different questions. And one of the questions we have been tasked to answer is, what does the notice mean to the people who get it? And one really good way of figuring that out is asking what it means to a bunch of target consumers, or recipients in this case. Now, if we could guarantee that we were going to get 500 notice recipients, it might be reasonable to say, let's only ask actual notice recipients what they thought. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're much more likely to get people who did register or would register in a new GTLD, enough of them to get a decent sample. But in that case, we got to show them the notice and try and figure out what it means to them. So, and that is real data. It's not hypothetical. It's a comprehension question, which is the kind of thing that surveys ask all the time. So I believe the only way we're going to get an answer to the question, how do people understand this notice, is by showing it to people and asking them what they think. And once we do that, they need a way to think about it.
Thank you very much. Rebecca, Kathy, please.
Right, this is Kathy. And that makes sense to me. That is the target question here. And I just wanted to confirm with everybody, since I apologize, I was not here for the beginning of the survey, that this is a registrant survey, but it's completely possible that 99% of the registrants are in the GTLDs. That's my sense going back and looking at the beginning, but maybe, I mean, so that idea of having the hypothetical to make sure that we ask those, this target group, I like that term, of people who are already pretty well, obviously know what a domain name is, asking them the question. But let me just double check and stop there. Is it possible that most of the people who have taken the survey are in the legacies? Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And I see we have Christine, please.
This is Christine. I think we're trying to account for that for this survey because the very first question is, have you registered domain names in the new GTLDs, or have you registered domain names in the last 5 years or in the new GTLDs? So we were trying to filter for that. We are trying to get people, by the time you get to this, you should have already registered domain names or attempted to, actually no, in this case, you should have already registered domain names in the new GTLDs by the time you see this question on this specific survey. You may not have seen a claims notice, so there's some questions that say, have you seen a claims notice, what did you do? But this section, I believe, is trying to capture, for those of you who have registered domain names in the new GTLDs but didn't actually see a claims notice yet, here is one, what would you do? That's, I think, what this section is trying to get at, but I admit I am incredibly under-caffeinated, so I may not be following along. Thanks.
This is can I add to that?
Yes, please. Go ahead. And then after Rebecca, Kathy, please.
So I just want to confess error here. I should have fought harder on this earlier on. It never made a lot of sense to do registrants and potential registrants as completely separate surveys. And in fact, as some of my comments indicate, part of this is putting people on the right path, right? Because in fact, the class potential registrants includes people who tried to register GTLD and failed for whatever reason, and people who haven't but would legitimately consider doing it. And so a lot of these are just overlapping paths to the same question. It's actually one survey with branching paths. And then, some people who won't qualify for any of those paths. Honestly, I could live with a survey that said I have received a claims notice and didn't ask the use cases. If that's the hurdle here, if the people who really have received claims notices get asked only about their stuff and not the use cases, I can live with that. What I would like to make sure happens in that scenario, though, is that those people are also given an opportunity to refresh their recollection of what the claims notice said. And again, this may also provide them an opportunity to say, oh, actually, I didn't get a claims notice.
you should be giving me the other part of the survey.
Thank you very much. And before I go to Kathy, I'm looking at page 29, and I'm looking at the sort of the alternative to the hypothetical. And I'm wondering if that's what we're sort of getting back to, where we can still try to get to a state of mind, you know, what would you do if you got one of these? Because you haven't gotten one of these, but here's a claims notice. And there's a, you know, then a series of questions in that, the, you know, other, on the other hand option, that tries to get to sort of the same place, but without using a hypothetical. And, I think, Susan, you said earlier something like, well, I would be happy with the option on page 29. I don't know if you were talking about the non-hypothetical response there, or approach, should I say. And Kathy, please, and I realize we're 2 minutes after the hour, so I think we'll be needing to wrap this up. And actually, Stacy needs to drop off, so I think we're going to have to pick this up at our next call. But Kathy, I'll give you the last word.
I think the last word is I'm gonna think about it, but that idea of having registrants of new GTLDs in front of us, and thank you to Christine for clarifying that, but that those registrants may have come in after the trademark claims notice period, but still putting it in front of them in some way and asking what you think about this, and I think is really important. So it sounds like we have a lot to think about.
It does, and. And thank you all, and thank you, Stacy, so much for staying on. And just and I know you have to leave, so we do have a call scheduled for Monday. This was added in, and we did ask if people could let us know if they were not able to join on Monday. And Monday's call is actually at 1700 UTC, so starting 1 hour later than this, because there's otherwise an overlap with another GNSO meeting. Are people able to join on Monday? Ah, Christine says, preschool graduation on Monday. That's very important. Let me ask Susan, Rebecca, and I think Rebecca in particular, we would need you if you would be able to join. We don't mind being second fiddle to your five-year-old. Sorry, that's great, Christine. Rebecca, Susan, Lori, Phil, others. Lori says I may be able to join half, just not first half. Rebecca, would you be able to join us at that time on Monday?
I should be. Shoot, but I have to go. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Let me let you go, and we'll send around a notice, and if folks can't join, you know, we'll ask people to let us know. And I'm just reading the chat. But thank you, everyone, for joining. Phil can't join. Christine could join very early on Monday. Okay. And Susan says it's not the best time. I can if I have to, but not ideal. Kathy says I checked and I can join. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for your comments, and we'll get a notice out. Perhaps if we can make it a little bit earlier, I'll just have to check. Thanks, Susan. Maybe if we can make it an hour earlier, we'll try to see if we can do that. We'll just have to check with the support staff. Yes, noted, Lori. We're trying to bring these to an end. We promise. Well, thank you all for joining. It's now 6 after, and sorry to hold you up. And we'll work out something for Monday. We're getting very close to finishing, which is great. Thanks again. And, Michelle, let's go ahead and adjourn the call.
Meeting has been adjourned.